This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code datanauts30. I'm so old that I remember when tape was a thing that mattered for backup. Not that I have to be that old. I mean, I know there's plenty of you out there who are still using tape to back up your data, but should tape even be a part of the backup rotation these days? Aren't there better ways to back up our data and still have timely access to it? And then I got to thinking about it. What does a modern backup system look like anyway? I've been so deep in the mires with networking that I've kind of lost touch with the backup world. And then I said, I know someone that can answer that question for me. My co-host, Chris Wall, and that's what we're going to talk about today on Datanauts. At packetpushers.net, you can find this and all of our Datanauts shows about infrastructure engineering, or just search for Datanauts, spelled kind of like astronauts, in your favorite podcatcher. You can follow us at datanauts_show. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks, and with me is the fabulous Chris Wall at Chris Wall, who once drank Coke with Pop Rocks and lived to tell about it. So Chris, how you doing, buddy? It does seem that you are a backup expert, because in the spirit of full disclosure, after all, you do work for a company called Rubrik that's in that space.
Well, hold on here. I got to finish eating my Pop Rocks and Coke. That's disgusting, man. That's horrible.
It is. But you survived, and that's the important part.
Fancy enough. Yeah. I work in that space. I don't really consider myself a backup expert per se, because I feel like those are the people that have been doing it for 10 or 20 years and have all the scars. I avoided many of the scars. I got to offload some of it to other folks, but I certainly live in that space now and get to help those who have the scars see the light.
Yeah, and for me, it's years ago, I was installing Veritas systems on Novell, and there were tape drives, and you set up your grandfather, father, son rotation, and you install your extra drivers so that, oh, now we can back up Microsoft Exchange, and oh, now we can back up SQL. Dude, that was a long time ago. We're going back 15 years or more that was a thing. And I know some of that is still true because I've looked at some backup technology and it's kind of there still. You still have those same needs, but yet the technology has moved on so much and the storage market has moved on so much. And it kind of feels to me like backup is like a tier of storage now rather than this separate application and process and thing. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Sort of. I mean, for a lot of people, the reality you describe is still the daily grind. You know, they're still dealing with architectures. You talk about Veritas and Novell and 10 plus years ago. For a lot of people, that reality is the same, right? I mean, it's a new version, the new sticker, maybe some new bits of software, but the actual like workflows and the technology largely is the same for a number of folks. Unlike the sexy world of networking, the backup world hasn't really gotten a lot of attention. It doesn't get a lot of eyeballs from the VCs and the cool hipster West Coast coding guys and gals.
Well, let's position backup in the context of how storage is defined these days. And I'm getting back into the storage world as well and trying to polish up whatever chops I ever had in that realm. And it seems like the terms today, you've got primary storage and you've got secondary storage, and maybe you've got nearline or offline storage. How do you fit backup into that terminology?
Sure. And realistically, across the grand scheme of backup, the use of disk is pretty new. You know, it was maybe late last decade that disk really started hitting the primary workflows for these systems. And there are a lot of, well, there's some marketing terms around it, the primary, secondary, et cetera. I think that's just more to fit within like budgets and marketing schemas and things like that. I mean, realistically, you got storage and you pick what it's going to be used for. As an example, for some companies having a combination of flash and disk is a screaming performer. That's their primary storage array. It runs all of their critical workloads. Maybe for a large enterprise, that's like their backup system, and they want all flash arrays for everything else. So it's a little bit of eye of the beholder. What they're trying to actually outline is primary storage is where the active data set is being written to and read from for workloads and applications that are actually serving IO and user workloads, with the concept of secondary storage meaning there's nothing active going on there, at least from a production perspective, but that's where I'm putting data either for pre-production or to actually store for long-term archive, for compliance, whatnot. And then the offline storage world is a couple different things. It could be the more classic use of the term with tape libraries, you know, where you put them in the folks like Iron Mountain, and you're just trying to get it offsite, completely isolated, completely air-gapped. Or it could be some form of bastardization where you're talking about object storage or like NFS or something like that, where it's really just saying, I'm going to put it there. I'm probably going to enable something like Worm, the write once, read many architecture where it can't be modified. And that's kind of like my tape library, but with a new spin on it.
So it feels like the logic behind why I'm doing backups and how hasn't necessarily changed all that much, except as you said, the advent in the last several years of starting to use older, maybe slower disk as a big pool with which to back up my stuff. And then you mentioned something interesting, this term of secondary storage, where it's, yes, that could be backup in a way, but would also could be staging your data before it goes to production because you're doing development work on it. So there's some kind of a data set like that out there.
I'm not actually a huge fan of the term because let's say we're talking about pre-production, stage, QA, whatever it is that's not prod, aren't those important as well? At my last company, as an example, when I was in the end user space, we had 500 or 600 developers. Certainly having the pre-production place where the developers were working offline was a heck of a lot of money per hour being dumped in the toilet. It's tough to really define what's production and what's not outside of the pure definition of what is a user hitting or not. But there's certainly also some value to tiering your storage, but it's something we've classically done. You know, we've had our fast prod stuff and our slower. We typically do it like heat maps, like our fast and hot storage, and then our colder or slow storage. Anyways, I think the use of primary and secondary is just yet another way that we can help tier out our storage logically in our minds.
I started thinking about the types of backups, whereas before it was, okay, my backup means I go and I pull from the tape and I put it in and I press the magic button on the software and it pulls the file that it backed up last night and it's restored. But today there's really kind of a lot of forms of backup or things that I think you could categorize as backup. You correct me if I'm just being silly, but snapshots in the virtual machine world, the traditional file system backups where you've got some point in time backup of what that file system looked like. Then there's, of course, the also traditional, the application level backups, things like your mail system at an app layer where you can individually restore messages, SQL database where you can bring back tables and records and so on. Then there's cloud service kind of backups. And if you start reading up about Amazon Web Services, they'll tell you how to use their different tiers of storage for backup or not, depending on what your use case is. For example, they'll position S3 versus Glacier, which is very slow storage. Glacier is versus S3, which is more real-time useful, for example. And so there's all these different kinds of data to backup, then ways in which that you can backup and targets you can back it up to.
Exactly. And that's, well, I'll argue on the snapshots being classified as a backup because that typically is not, or it's massaged as being so, but really is not a backup because in a lot of cases, it doesn't provide any actual rich services around restoring data. It's just, here's the known state of data on a storage array, and it's kept within the storage array. And in order to really be a backup, you have to be able to recover around a failure. So if the storage array is the point of failure in some way, shape, or form, or it gets hacked or deleted or user error or something like that, and it also contains what you're considering a backup being snapshots, that's a tough one to argue being a backup. Even if you're replicating those snapshots somewhere else, that's kind of a poor man's backup system because it's really, it's all one kind of code base and it is mutable, not immutable, but actually mutable by an administrator. And again, all those rich services that you're looking to provide typically require some additional installation or it's just complex. I would argue, I think the industry is pretty good on agreeing that snapshots aren't backups per se. They're certainly helpful if you're trying to just make a known good state and you're installing a new application, you want to roll back from it, but you certainly wouldn't bet the farm on, you know, I got a snapshot on my storage array, I'm good to go.
I wouldn't want to bet the farm on it. I think of snapshots as a tool in the toolkit, handy for operations in certain circumstances.
The rest of it's interesting because as you vary between what you brought up between like file system and files and pieces and parts within partitions and volumes, all the way up to cloud services, really the challenge isn't so much wrapping your head around the workflow, right? You know, we're either going to grab a file or a folder, we're going to quest an application and say, hey, give me your data and dump it somewhere. It's more been a challenge of how close is the person that's responsible for protecting the data to the actual data itself from an understanding perspective, from a workflow perspective. And the challenge has historically been outside of like database administrators and very focused application people, folks that are specialized and skilled in specific applications, It's really hard, if not impossible, to wrap your arms around all the applications that are running the enterprise, to have a deep knowledge, to understand when should I provide a backup, what's the best way to back it up, you know, what's the best time or place, or, you know, so a lot of cases what gets done is you just say, well, here's a bunch of stuff, and it's not super, super critical, so I'm just going to take a backup at 2 a.m., or you pick some kind of arbitrary time, and then you have a few, those tip of the iceberg, very specialized, very financially critical applications that you have a DBA involved with, or an exchange administrator involved with, or some application level person involved with, to make sure that it's protected kind of at that level. It's been a challenge to holistically look at the data center and say, here's what we're going to do strategically and tactically to back up all those things. It's so much. And then you add cloud to the mix. It's like, ugh, just bash your head against the wall in frustration. So, but those definitely are types of backups and data sources that we're looking at to provide data services around.
Now, some people might think, well, I'm doing replication, storage replication, or whatever sort of replication to disaster recovery data center that's offsite, different geographic region. That's my backup. But that isn't really backup, is it?
Yeah, that's more disaster recovery in my mind. It's part of the package. Really, backup is the idea of, am I able to withstand any normal infrastructure failures and still retrieve the data in the way that I need it? Like, let's say we have snapshots or replicating the data to somewhere else. The issue with both of those, like I brought up before in the snapshots, is that there's still kind of that single point of failure in that if I'm replicating a bad set of data to somewhere else, then I just have a lot of bad sets of data in multiple places. You know, it's not actually versioning and controlling the source of the data. It's not making sure that it can't be overwritten. There's no real governance or compliance over the data from a control perspective. And realistically, a lot of these models assume that you want to just restore it in one manner. You know, if I'm replicating, then I can only restore what was replicated. I can't pick out pieces of it. I can't necessarily use cloud because maybe I don't want to replicate all of it, or it doesn't deduplicate, or it doesn't compress, or whatever. So I think replication is a good strategy from a disaster recovery perspective. You know, your DR plan should include having the data somewhere else so it's quickly available. You know, you don't want to just throw it in a tape and put it in a footlocker at the bottom of your bed. That's hard to recover from. But certainly it's not a backup in and of itself.
What about dealing with faraway data? It used to be that, you know, one solution was, well, for remote offices, we're going to keep all the data in a central data center. The remote offices are going to hit us with a web interface, and there's not going to be any super important data that we need to back up at those remote offices. But now, it kind of seems like data can live in a lot of places, or data could be up in the cloud, and their distance we've got tends to be less network available to us, less bandwidth. And then that bandwidth may be higher latency because it's just geographically further away, which can also impede our throughput trying to back up to some target. Is there a strategy for backing up that sort of data?
Yeah, I think it was Dave McRory that brought up the idea of data gravity back when he was at Warner. And it's just the realization that as you create data, more data kind of goes around it. It has its own gravity, its own kind of weight in the IT ecosystem. That's certainly true for remote sites, branch offices, etc. I remember trying to run a bunch of branch offices. Realistically, these were schools. We try to keep them as stateless as possible. It's just impossible. They just create data. It's like, come on, guys, come back to the root file server. But there's always just these things that occur out there, or we're echoing a file system into a remote location and then syncing back the changes. And so there's a couple things that have certainly helped over the years. The idea of data efficiencies, you know, dedupe, compress, WAN acceleration, caching systems from vendors where they can actually just kind of echo kind of a shadow copy out to a remote site and then just pull in the changes in a very highly efficient manner are all good ways to make sure that the data is available and yet also synchronized back to headquarters. And that highlights one strategy where you just make sure that everything does pull back in some efficient manner to your primary site or sites and then actually back up at that layer. Something that's been a little more popular is actually establishing repositories in an object or cloud store that's kind of globally federated. And that way you can use like a cable modem or a DSL or something at a remote site that has a lot of bandwidth, but it's not necessarily super reliable. And that way you're not having to make these super trunks back into headquarters. You can just use the remote site bandwidth into a cloud or object store that's kind of distributed, because that's the nature of object store. Have them upload at that point and then kind of lazy synchronization across that cloud at that layer. And at that point, you're relying on the provider to really supply the replication schema behind the covers. So there's some new ways to do it, but realistically, you got data, you got to move it there somewhere. You can't just rely on a sales guy and a tape drive and tell them to put it in their closet every weekend, because I used to do that. And guess what? They don't do that work. It doesn't actually happen. It's like, oh, well, the tape thing broke a couple months ago, but I didn't tell anybody. Why not? So don't rely on just random person.
Sponsoring today's DataKnots is IT Pro TV, a repository of training for certifications. Now, several of you have asked me directly whether they are the real deal or not. So here is my honest impression. When they came to us a few months back, I spent a couple of hours on their site browsing through the catalog, using the interface, and sampling the course offerings. And so the short story is this. If I was working on a cert these days, IT Pro TV would definitely be a resource I'd consider. There is a ton of material, over 1,000 hours of videos. They add more every week. You can consume the videos on any sort of device you want. The classes are diverse. There's network stuff like CCENT, CCNA, etc., but then also Red Hat and certified ethical hacker training. So it's a really good library. And then you can sanity check that you're ready to take the real exam because they have virtual labs and they have Transcender practice exams that are included. And to me, that is a really big deal because the real exams are expensive. So it's good stuff there, but if you don't like it for whatever reason, you can cancel with no hassle. So if you are interested in group pricing, by the way, and already have an account with some other training company, IT Pro TV will match your previous year's pricing as an enticement to switch. They really want your business and will work to keep it affordable for your group. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to access the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year. But we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Visit itpro.tv/datanauts, use the code DATANAUTS30, and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account. Chris, a growing problem we have is just that, growing. Data is growing, and it's very easy now. I bought a 5 terabyte drive, USB 3, at home because I'm doing some video editing work. And that was cheap. It was $150. That wasn't enterprise grade or anything, but I'm just making the point that you can buy terabytes for not a lot of money these days, so even at an enterprise scale, and enterprises are storing more and more data. I'm hearing about, I saw a presentation from a Tech Field Day vendor called Igneous Systems. They sell in 212 terabyte chunks. That's just, oh, you want to use us? 212 terabytes, that's where you start. You need more, then you're going to buy an additional 212 terabytes, et cetera. And there's people that are out there now with petabyte systems. It's becoming not uncommon to hear about that sort of data being out there. So my question is, when you're dealing with hundreds of terabytes or more of data, how do you get it backed up in a timely fashion? What are the strategies for that?
I mean, in a word, it's parallelism. And in a longer set of words, it's really just abandoning a lot of the architecture that we've come to know in the past. I mean, traditionally, there's utility servers or proxy servers or media servers or whatever the vendor calls them that are deployed to help scale out a backup system. And think of these kind of like little inroads to whatever the storage target is for writing the data to get it out of the primary and into the backup storage target. And these proxies or utility nodes are assigned a number of tasks. They go out and they back up 10, 100,000, whatever virtual machines and physical workloads they need to. And that's because they're responsible for perhaps deduping or compressing or looking at the write streams, and they have so much CPU and disk and things like that. So that's been the historical method. That the challenge there is that it requires either a lot of hardware, a lot of control points. It's consuming resources somewhere in the environment. Even if it's a virtual machine, it needs some disk to write kind of like a stash file so that it can construct the deduplication chains and actually look at the fingerprints.
Because you need metadata to be able to put it all back together again.
Exactly. You also have to make sure that you're not overloading the source where you're grabbing the data from. So a lot of times a virtual machine can offload that because it has CPU and memory and some kind of staging disk space so that it can start constructing that file that ultimately gets sent to the backup storage target. Or there's some kind of agent in what it's backing up and it's doing source ID deduplication, compression, and it's using resources from the data source, right? And that was the strategy because realistically, the master servers can only hold so much bandwidth and only handle so much I.O. And so this was kind of like a way to have worker bees out there grabbing data. But then the bottleneck shifts into different places. You know, really, it's largely been a management bottleneck. That's been the historical method to grab large pieces of data. The challenge there is that still the back-end systems are a choke point. And so that the more modern way that the folks have been looking to approach that is let's actually scale out all of the ingest points and distribute the software layer so there is no kind of like single master or dual master, so that all of the scale out control points can kind of decide what to do in a Borg-like fashion. That's the idea of let's actually look at the problem of the data center holistically rather than as individual jobs or tasks or processes that have to be done. And that way you can more advantageously and more proactively grab large sets of data. The other part of your question, or at least the answer to the other part of your question, is that we're starting to see vendors actually introduce things like Flash into a backup product. Because if you think about it, there's no such thing really as sequential writes when you start doing multi-node or multi-server backup. You know, even if each individual stream is sequential, aggregated across them, they become random in some cases. It's kind of that IO blender effect we see in the virtualization world. And so Flash is great at handling any kind of random that you throw at it. It's not the best for heavy amounts of writes, but if you can dedupe and soak up a lot of those writes more opportunistically somewhere in the front end, either on the source side or in memory or in cache, and then lay it out and drop it to disk somewhere, that's another way that you can do this in a timely fashion.
I mean, are you describing Flash as a caching tier then, just to help with that laying out that data process on the back end, or Flash as a primary storage tier for the backed up data?
Just as a cache. I would think it would be awesome to have an all-flash backup storage. Now you got me thinking. That seems like it'd be a lot of money, though.
I don't think the economics are there yet for Flash, but boy, okay. I was just trying to be real clear on exactly the role that Flash would be playing in that. But so another question that pops to mind then, if I've got hundreds of terabytes I'm storing or more in my primary fancy, super fast and amazing storage array, and now I'm trying to back up all that data, I still need to have hundreds of terabytes on my secondary storage or backup tier as well, do I not?
Not necessarily. There's a lot of ways to solve that problem. I would say that first and foremost, it highlights the need to have a scale-out storage system as your backup target, right? If you're going to lay it on disk on-prem or somewhere else, it doesn't make sense to have the traditional dual controller model or a shelf-based model because it's going to have a choke point. Either it's going to run out of the ability to add capacity, the number of SAS channels just won't make sense anymore. The head unit just won't be able to keep up with what's going on. So you're really going to need something that can scale.
By scale out, you mean you're going to add another group of disks to this system, and the system has been constructed in such a way that you're laying your data out across every disk node that is in that system. And the more nodes you add, the greater your capacity grows and the greater your throughput grows as well, your ability to write data across that system.
I would simplify it even more than that. It's just saying that when you scale the system, you're not just growing capacity, you're also scaling in a linear fashion the performance and the management capabilities. Because if you think about it, with disk shelves, the only thing you scale is capacity. You don't get any more performance, maybe potentially some write performance, but from a controller perspective, you can't actually ingest more data because it all hits a backplane and that goes to a SAS channel in most cases, like 6 gig SAS. And so, in fact, the more capacity you add, the less overall performance you have. You're diluting your performance. In the case of scale out, yes, you're adding compute along with performance, and the ability to provide capacity is kind of almost a second nature thing to that. Because if you think about it, long-time architecture has always been about solve for performance and capacity will just be done. You never solve capacity and then go back and figure out performance. So every time we size storage arrays when I was in the channel and as an end user, we'd always figure out how many IOPS we needed, what block size, that kind of jazz. You do the math, you solve that problem. And then pretty much every time, capacity is already like way solved. You know, like you're over capacity. It wasn't until we had all flash arrays that we could really almost solve performance before capacity. You know, that was the first time where we had to like make sure the other way around was solved. So this is that same case. The other part of it is the system itself doesn't necessarily need to hold all of the data. As an example, my company has deployed multi-petabyte systems for people that have just gigantic amounts of data. But you could just lay out a number of days or months of data onto the system and then put it somewhere else for the longer term retention. And that's where being able to consume things like cloud and object and file as almost a third tier, it's still available, but it's not necessarily as performant. You know, you can start using things like you talked about Nearline or just plain old SAS and SATA disk using something like Object Store really solves that problem for the, they call it cheap and deep storage. So that you can scale that out massively. And that's where object storage I think, is the bee's knees in that particular
one. But that gives you the versioning, so you can actually have multiple copies of your backup and some history there. I want to back up a second. One thing is, just because you've got data living on your primary tier doesn't necessarily mean you have to back it up. Is that fair? You're not going to back up every bit that's ever been written to a disk.
Yeah. In some cases, there's way more not being backed up than it is. It's certainly intelligent to be careful with what you're backing up. There's two reasons for that. One, you might have some stuff that you would break compliance if you backed it up. You have to scrub it. You have to sanitize it. It has to be compliant. So to put something in a long-term retention, plain text serial numbers or socials or something like that would be bad. You'd have to make sure that you're compliant with that. And number two, there's a lot of data you just don't care about. Remember the old Microsoft Outlook, the PST files?
Yes.
You know, the little, yeah, like the endpoint backups. You always want to exclude those. And there's like kind of frivolous stuff like MP3s and that kind of jazz. But there's really just a lot of like cache files, temp files, tempdb is an example, scratch files. There's swap files in the VMware world. There's actually a lot of garbage just floating out there. And being intelligent by filtering it just makes sense. Otherwise, you're just wasting a lot of time and space.
Okay. And so you're still going to have a lot of data that is important, but then you're going to keep at least one set of it on that, as you said, somewhat performant secondary tier. And then for versions beyond that, maybe you push that up into the cloud, or maybe you, dare I say it, maybe you push that off the tape. Because we've been talking about large data sets. So maybe that's another question. Is it even worth talking about tape when you're talking about hundreds of terabytes of data?
I'm a bit crusty on that. I just got burned so bad by tape. As a medium, I think tape was great at solving problems that we used to have. Like, I need lots of capacity that's really cheap, that writes very sequentially in a quick manner, and I can rehydrate from it pretty reasonably fast as long as it's all a sequential read of an entire data stream. I think it was okay at doing that. And it also allowed you to get things off-site in a reasonably easy manner. Because what did we have before? We had challenges where capacity was very expensive, performance was expensive, networking, especially at the WAN layer, was ultra expensive. I remember spending thousands of dollars on like a fractional T1.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, 384K, baby. I'm blazing. You know, now it's like, all right, do you want a GigaMan, dual GigaMan? I got gigabit to the house. So bandwidth is certainly much, much cheaper. But also the economics of tape are quickly falling out of favor. The 10 years ago answer was, of course you go with tape. It's like a penny a gig or a terabyte or whatever it ends up being once you buy in bulk. And now with things like Object Store, which allows you to actually globally federate the data over these really cheap WAN pipes, either in the data center for parts of it, or you may have a multi-region strategy where you build sites where you say, you know, I always want two replicas, put one in Virginia and one in California, something like that. That's a strategy. And if your backup system is writing data efficiently, meaning it's deduped and compressed and the metadata is associated with it, then you don't even need really fancy object store. You just need kind of dumb object store. But then there's also the idea of tiering out based on the age of data, right? You could say, I want to keep a week or a month or something of data on premises within some kind of that primary landing point for the data, and then shuck it off to that cheap storage elsewhere. And then the third thing is that the part where I have the scars from the tape was that so many times I'd go to restore the tape and it didn't work. Like, that sucks.
Because the media's got a life and that life had expired or something else?
Couple reasons. Either it's user error, because these things are like time bombs. Yeah, you can read back the data and it'll say, yeah, the CRC check came back good and it's all there, but maybe I screwed up the backup job, or I didn't grab what I needed to, or there was an error somewhere. I mean, fixing a backup job that's going to a tape is not trivial. That's typically you let it run at night, you go to bed, you wake up, and you hope it's done. And if it's not, you're kind of screwed. That opportunity to write to that tape is just over. You could try to rerun it, but you're eventually going to trip on your own feet if you keep trying to fix that job. So you kind of get one shot at it. If it's not successful, maybe you don't know about it. But yeah, you're right. I would typically restore tapes no older than 90 days. It wasn't like I was going back to something that was 3 years old. I think only a couple times in my life have I gone past a year old for a tape. But I would just get a media error or a read error. I would try to grab something and it was corrupted or fragmented. I was like, this sucks. And you don't know until you need the data. So it's like having these little time bombs in the data center or off the data center. So that's why I just don't think it's a good idea.
Dealing with the performance challenges around backing up large sets of data in a timely fashion, do you see folks in that situation building a dedicated backup network where, assuming their target is across Ethernet somewhere, they're wanting to devote Ethernet bandwidth strictly to the elephant flows of a backup?
Not really. I think with 10 gig and the enhancements to Ethernet, and you obviously know those way better than I do, but with like priority flow control, 10 gig Ethernet being everywhere, a lot of the data being virtualized so that you can kind of slice and dice it at a VLAN or port group level. It feels like it's more trouble than it's worth to carve out a dedicated backup network. I mean, if you're really worried about it, you can make Greg Farrow pissed off and use quality of service, QoS as he calls it. I know he hates QoS. So you could go that level, but realistically, a lot of the sources that we're grabbing from are intelligent enough not to just screw over the workloads that they're serving, but more realistically, modern day data protection services can actually see the physical and the virtual workloads, what they're doing. They're looking at I/O, they're looking at latency. They're trying to figure out, am I trying to back up multiple data sources that are sharing the same backend storage or data store? Are they unique? And so the system itself is going to kind of throttle and massage the I/O, the elephant flows, like you talk about, how much bandwidth is being consumed, how big is the window, and they'll handle that for you. I feel like if you're working with a system where you have to control that, you're probably in that, you know, slightly legacy type architecture. That's got to be tough to try to look across all the network flows in an entire data center and pick like 2 a.m. Like, who picks that time? You know, it seems like just some rando time.
So, Chris, I've backed up a ton of data. I've got a lot of it close by me sitting there. Is it useful or is it just sitting there? Is there something I can get out of that data that I've backed up?
You're talking about if you back up all those cat photos? You can still look at the cat photos. It's okay. So, but more seriously, it kind of depends, right? So if you're putting it into tape, no, that data's gone. You don't have any access to it. And that's another kind of like womp womp when it comes to offline data, or like I think the marketing thing is like dark data. It's dark. So realistically, if it's somewhere that's available, like object store, file store, et cetera, yeah, it's all there. The question is, can you serve it up, A, in an easy manner? Because if it's hard to get to or complex, no one's going to take the time to get to it. They're like, oh, this sucks. And they'll just use the primary data sets, or they'll do local backups, or they'll just mirror the data somewhere else as a working set. So that's the first dependency. The second dependency is there actually performance behind what's storing the data, so that when I need to go grab it and do something with it as like a working set, like we talked about earlier, that quote unquote secondary storage array, does it have enough performance and pep in it to actually do the things that I need it to do? And so the last generation of backup focused storage arrays had horrible read performance. I'm talking horrible, because they were designed for writes, right? I would need a nice large pipe to write in data from multiple sources. But good luck reading. I'm talking, you know, maybe 500 IOPS available for reads across, you know, a big chunk of iron. You're like, oh, that's terrible.
Let's pretend I'll never need it again. Right.
Yeah, it's great. The demo is always, look, we can instantly recover a single virtual machine or a single working data set. Like, that's great. What about like 100 of them? Like, don't press that button because it will die everywhere. The performance is the other challenge. And once you've solved for performance and you solve for the ease of use, then yeah, absolutely. That's the whole idea of turning what was traditionally like this insurance policy that was this just money dumpster that we had to feed every year to actually providing some value and doing some interesting things with it. I think those are the two major considerations in that particular arena, Ethan. Hey there. Each week, we put together a show focused on the amazing world of enterprise data centers and their constant challenges to tens of thousands of snazzy listeners. But hey, we're just scratching the surface. So vendors, send an email to sponsors@packetpushers.net for information on how you can build a quality, informative, and fun sponsored show with us, the DataDots podcast crew. We will create impactful content that doesn't suck. Woo! Again, that's sponsors@packetpushers.net.
Chris, we talked a bit about recovering data and some of the challenges of getting the data back, and you were dumping on tape in the negative way, not like dumping data, but just dumping on tape because it's a terrible media in a modern age. Taking a step back as we think about recovering data, would you say data recovery is these days, is it an ops responsibility or is it an end user responsibility?
Well, I would turn that question a little bit and say, what do both parties want it to be? The conversation is always ops wants, I think in most cases, users to be able to recover the data because they don't want to be data janitors, right? They just want to let the user get what they need. And the user often complains that ops is too slow or can't find what they need. I mean, we've all filled out those little help ticket things. You never actually get the response you're looking for the first time. They always screw it up, or they don't know what you're asking for. Or if you're an ops person, you get the ticket. You're like, the ticket says like, can't find file. You know, like, that's not helpful. I can't do anything with that. I think both parties kind of want it to be on the user. However, it's historically not been, outside of things like volume shadow services and previous versions that were available with like Microsoft Windows file servers and things like that. Most things require interjecting at least to the help desk layer. And that seems like a good starting point, but I feel like we're all trying to get to the point where you can just click buttons and things magically appear as a user.
So then, right, a follow-up question then is, do modern-day backup services offer a user-oriented interface so that users could go and grab data without help desk intervention? Or is it pretty much, it's an ops-oriented tool where someone who kind of knows how the system works is going to go in there and recover whatever the user's asked for?
I think at the file and folder, you know, kind of just unstructured data level, everyone out there pretty much has some sort of user-facing portal. Either it's intrinsic to the system or there's some kind of add-on licensing to make that operational. But I think that's been kind of presented holistically as a staple item of modern-day backup and recovery services. Now, as to how well they work, you know, that obviously varies considerably based on who set it up and what it's meant to do. I think the more challenging piece has been outside of just I have a backup of a file server and someone needs to, you know, get back their PowerPoint or whatnot. How do I get the next level of user the ability to restore what they need? And that's maybe a power user, the help desk team themselves, so they don't have to call back to ops, or even a developer or someone in sort of a development role where they need to request services to be restored, or they're actually doing it for pre-production workloads and they say, hey, I need 5 copies of yesterday's analytics server in some type of environment. That's a bit more challenging. And I think that's the more interesting way to scratch that itch. It's something I've personally been trying to solve, and working at Rubrik has been fun because we're trying to make that really easy for people.
Now, I know in the primary data storage, we've had all different kinds of methods for dealing with faults within the storage system. Oh, drive went bad or there's some kind of an issue. Well, great. We stripe the data and we can reconstruct what's in the missing chunk and put that stripe back together and present you with a complete set of data. And then automatically rebuild when you put a new disk in to replace the failed disk, et cetera. So that's not the question I'm about to ask you. The question that I want to know is, if you've lost a bit of data, if a file has gone away, is there any sort of an auto recovery mechanism where that data could be restored? Or am I just making things up?
Absolutely. It's really not a technology problem. It's just, who's going to trust that? You know, there's so many ways we could automate DR, we could automate recovery of services, applications, files. But it's kind of going back to this book I read on the site reliability engineering practice at Google. It's like they're in the mindset where everything has to auto heal, you know, from the application service file. It doesn't matter. Everything has to auto heal. That is not how the enterprise IT world works. I mean, for two major reasons. One, that's a huge culture shift to say, all right, everything we do has to just fix itself. And number two, that's a lot of work. I mean, do you even know what is considered a fault and what your, you know, SLA is for that fault? And to write a system that can handle every oddball thing a user does and recover from it, if you've got that going on, you've invented Skynet. That's amazing. You definitely should sell that for a lot of money. So definitely from a technology perspective, you can do it. And to be a little less cynical, there are certainly things that I've worked with some of my customers and as a user to say, yeah, when these certain events trigger, such as, you know, let's say we couldn't take a backup because of some reason, to automatically remediate that. It's called the self-healing data center, and I've done some presentations on that. And you can apply that as well to, if this file is missing, replace it. That's starting to enter in the configuration management world where you're basically persisting the existence of something, but commonly that's not really just like a user file or something. That's a config or a profile or a class or something like that.
It's state enforcement. You're saying things should look like this, and if it doesn't,
yeah,
make it look like that.
And the way that you make it look like that, you know, the after state that is desired is you have a system that you can pull from an API level and say, if this doesn't exist in a certain state or these properties don't exist for the object that is in the certain state, recover it to the previous state. And that's certainly something you can do with the APIs and orchestration engines that are available today.
We talked earlier about disaster recovery, and we mentioned replication, replicating to an offsite data center. That's not backup, but certainly would be a key element of our disaster recovery, having replicated data that we can access. But then backup data may play a role in disaster recovery as well. How would you describe that?
I think it should be pretty tightly coupled with DR. There's a couple primary use cases where you want to recover either on-prem, in a secondary kind of warm site, or just single file and folder. All those can kind of be related to DR because you could have any form of DR. People tend to think of DR as, especially with replication, as the meteor, like the asteroid has taken out my data center and the whole thing's a smoking crater. I can count on zero fingers how many times that has happened to me. It's typically user error is probably number one, with a very, very distant number two being hardware failure. And that's only number two because maybe we had to go cheap and bought a single point of failure, or we didn't realize we had a single point of failure because, you know, the architecture's changed so rapidly. And so back to your original question, I think it should be tightly coupled, because if we think about it to the earlier points I made, it's a way that we can pull data out of the primary system or the production system. We can replicate it. We can use object store to make it site resilient, geographically resilient. If I have all that data kind of dispersed opportunistically, I should also be able to bring back the data relatively quickly. So then it's really just a matter of, if I have that data kind of disaggregated and available in multiple places, do I have the compute resources and the network resources to make sure that there's servers available? And more in your arena, can I point users to it? Am I doing global load balancing? Where's the DNS pointing? Like, those are really the challenges. And that all kind of bubbles up into orchestration. So if you have a runbook that kind of both is the activities that need to be performed during a disaster recovery event, and is also kind of the source and truth for documentation, something like using Ansible for disaster recovery, or using VMware has Site Recovery Manager, SRM, that is, it tells you what's going to happen, so it's kind of documentation, and it enforces it. And that's where you can use your backup system to provide that data in multiple locations.
We mentioned the difficulties with tape. Again, we don't need to dump on it yet further, but there is a valid point.
I'll burn that flag. You know, it's no problem.
There's a point worth bringing up in that media that you back things up to have lifetimes. And I'm wondering how many enterprises are out there with data, tapes they've had in storage at Iron Mountain for a year or years. How long are those tapes actually good? And what other media might have a lifetime? Or even if the media is good, the data can somehow become corrupt, such that we as enterprises should have a routine of checking the validity of our backup data on a regular basis. Is that something you have a recommendation on?
That's a tough one, especially from the tape perspective, because most of the places I worked had this really stupid policy of infinite retention. Infinite. Like, we're never going to get rid of this data. That's the dumbest thing ever.
It's like storing nuclear waste.
Yeah, like, who actually signed off on that at, like, the higher level to say, like, we'll keep data forever? I mean, at least make it to the point where it's not going to be, like, in 100 years, who cares? Like, none of us will exist. You just get rid of the data. But you're working under constraints that are much, much more intense than the typical, like, seven-year federal or compliance-based regulations. And so that's tough, especially because the tapes in those type environments are 10, 20 years old. Like, they're garbage. I remember looking in the tape library at a previous job, and it was the old spool-like reels, like the, you know, the, what is it, 15-inch or 19-inch spools. I was like, I don't even have something that can read this.
Yeah.
Why are we even holding on to this? Like, that's this funny. Is so archaic.
Well, you're bringing
like,
back well, memories of know. Me as a computer operator. Back in the days at my college, I had a job as a computer operator. I'd go in at night, and part of what I did was deal with backups. I would have to put reel-to-reel tape on the Unisys box to have it do its thing. And right, if you were storing that data, first of all, what are you thinking if you don't have the system that you can read it from anymore? Second of all, what are the chances that magnetic media is still readable, even if you had something to read it with?
Even if it was pristine, like, who actually cares? Like, what is on there that is so important? Unless it's like, you know, the secrets to the universe, you know, like Zaphod Beeblebrox is going to come over and ask you for your freaking reel-to-reel. That's not going to happen. So there's obviously, there's the kind of business life to these things, which is infinite. And then there's the reality of, I don't know, after about a year, typically people don't care about this data. It's just being stored for really no reason. In fact, most all restores are within 90 days.
And if there are things that you have to store for purposes of compliance, like maybe you might get audited, or there's regulatory bodies that might come in and need you to pull some sort of records, you know, in that case, how do you make sure that the data that might be requested of you is accessible?
And that's a nightmare too, because if you think about it, what's the chances that the data you need is going to be on one, two, or even 10 tapes? You know, this is typically fragmented. Like, show me every email you've ever gotten for whatever for the past 5 years. Well, that's going to be on probably 60 to 70 tapes because you're doing dailies, weeklies, monthlies, and quarterlies or yearlies. So you're going to have to pull all these different tapes. You have to query a catalog to tell you where this data might be and then restore them. And it's just, it's not feasible, especially with the data growth that we have, the dynamicism of the data, where it's placed. It just, it does not work in a world where we're expecting data to be always on, available, services to be instantaneously brought up and killed within 30 seconds. I mean, this was designed for the era of, it takes 1-2 years to stand up a server. It's going to run for about maybe 5 to 7 years, and then I throw it away. And that's a project. And the server just did like one thing. So it's just not designed for that kind of system. Back to your other question, though, the validation of backup data. You know, I think there's two kind of questions there, really. There's, how do I make sure that there's not like, you know, bit flip or bit rot or something going on that is silently corrupting the data? And that's really up to the file system that is storing the data to say, all right, I've got the original CRCs or whatever it's using to validate that the data is there, and going back through and checking the consistency of that data. And depending on how you're actually laying it out on the file system, there's also the potential for collusion. You know, you could have some infinitesimally small chance of writing the same fingerprint, you know, using SHA-1 or whatever you're using. But that, again, is like one in like 500 zeros and then a one after it kind of percent chances. So it's just something to be aware of as data sets grow. So that's really up to the file system to make sure that there's no rot going on. The other more important and probably more neglected one is, how do I make sure that the backup data is restorable, right? That I got good data to begin with and that I can do something with it. And I think that plays into the thing I said earlier about the 90 days for most restores. Like, that's typically what you're looking for. And there's a lot of ways within that time frame to test to make sure that the data is actually usable. So if you've got some performance and you've got the ability to quickly provide data back, you know, through an API or management portal or something like that, you can automate that process and test it out. But ideally, since the data isn't, it's not dark data, we're talking about like, that's a cool Star Trek show that we should do with like, you know, evil data. And since it's not dark, you can get to it just about any time. And through the technologies available with something like object store and erasure coding and other technologies like that, dodging like single or double disk failure, node failure, you know, entire rack failure is actually pretty easy to do. So if the file system is making sure that the data is intact, it's being checked against the data that was pulled from, like at a CRC level, just to make sure what you were given is what you actually wrote. You're protecting against bit rot and bit flip at more of the file system layer. And then you're protecting against hardware failures kind of globally based on, you know, erasure coding and object store. It's really not a big issue. At that point, it's not like you have a media concern anymore. Like, if the disks go bad, they go bad all the time. That's fine. Just replace them. The system will self-heal around that. It's really just more making sure that you understand what is being protected and that you understand how to restore it into whatever, you know, that very first conversation we had. Is it a cloud-based backup? Are you backing up a file system or an application or entire virtual machine as an object? And realistically, those aren't that hard to restore.
All right, Mr. Wall, I think I've picked your brain enough for at least today about backup. I mean, not the most scintillating topic, but one of those things is I've been thinking about storage and becoming exposed to new ways to do primary storage. And the concept of secondary storage has actually been on my mind. How do you deal with backup these days? So thank you for letting me pick your brain. That was fun.
And I will say, it is a scintillating topic when your data's gone. Then it's like, oh man, I really care about backup right now. So I've been through that a few times. I'm like, I should have been backing that up.
Very fair. And that is it for today's episode of the Datanauts podcast. I am Ethan Banks. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter. And my blog is ethancbanks.com. And also, I am blogging at packetpushers.net. I encourage you to punk Chris at Chris Wall on Twitter or leave comments on his blog, wallnetwork.com. And for more of our Datanauts shows about infrastructure engineering, perform your very best backflip into the pool. That is packetpushers.net. You'll find the Datanauts talking about containers, conferences, certifications, cloud, career, and more with fabulous guests from all over. And hey, if you'd like to be internet famous, tweet your Datanauts-worthy story at us, and you might be our very next guest. And until then, may your server lights blink, your flash remain non-volatile, and your cables be cleanly managed. Very listenable delivery. Dark Data 2 would be fully operational.
I'm vibrating.
I should have chewed that. I totally should have chewed that.